Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are exploring the refugee situation in Africa. Joining us are two distinguished guests, Eskinder Negus, President and Chief Executive Officer of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And joining us from the Golden State City, San Diego, in California, of course, is Elizabeth Lau, the Chief Executive Officer of the Nairo Sisters Initiative. I have to say, first of all, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Well, thank you, Shaka. Thank you very much for inviting us. As you know, this is not my first time talking to you, so I wanted to just recognize, your interest on the issue of refugees and in Africa and globally. So we're very grateful that, as you know, African refugees don't necessarily get media attention. So for you to focus on this issue, I think we are quite grateful. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Mr. Negash.
I also would like to say thank you so very much for this opportunity to be here. What an honor to be in the air with a great man like you and in a great station. This is my first time to join the Voice of America. I am so honored. Thank you so much.
Profoundly honored for your compliments and support. Let me come to you immediately, Mr. Eskinder Negash. What is the refugee situation like in Africa from your vantage point?
Well, thank you, Shaka. Before talking up to Africa, I just want to give you just a brief overview of the global refugee situation. As we speak, according to UNHCR, 80 million forcibly displaced people worldwide. About 45.7 million are internally displaced, and then we have about 26.3 million are refugees. And as you know, 67% of all refugees are coming from five countries. Of course, the Syrian crisis, Venezuela, Afghanistan, but South Sudan is also about 2.3 million people. So the situation for African countries is not getting better. In fact, if I may say, the situation for African refugees is getting worse in Africa. Because of that crisis in Africa, a lot of refugees have decided to leave the continent and hoping to get resettled in other countries. Currently, as we speak, there are about 1.4 million refugees are in Uganda. About 39% of refugees are hosted in Turkey, Colombia, Pakistan, and of course, Uganda. So the African refugee situation is actually getting worse simply because the conflicts in different parts of the continent is continuing. As you know, in South Sudan, we spent the past 3, 4 years in conflict that created millions of displaced people. Currently, the Ethiopian crisis is generating over 60,000 refugees going back to Sudan. That is in addition to over 100,000 Eritrean refugees who have been there since 1968. So the refugee camp in Kenya is also the same. The Dadaab has been there since 1991. And then you have also another camp near the Sudan, also still there. So overall, I think the situation for African refugees is getting worse. And I say that also because of the COVID crisis. As you know, if you are a refugee in refugee camp or in urban setting, COVID has impacted many of them. And in fact, we don't even know how many urban refugees or refugees in general has been impacted by COVID. And as we now start speaking in terms of vaccine, I don't believe that refugees, African refugees or other refugees will be a priority, because we see some kind of vaccine nationality. So they are not a priority. So the situation overall for African refugee is actually getting worse and better.
You talk about the situation being compounded by the COVID-19 situation. What about the policies of the previous U.S. administration? What can you tell us about that?
Well, as you know, the previous U.S. administration has been very harsh when it comes to refugees and migrants. As you know, most African countries, including the Muslim ban, impacted Africa. And the number of refugees admitted to the U.S. was the lowest since 1975. So it did impact the number of asylum seekers to the U.S. also, to some extent, didn't get a chance to apply. So the previous administration policy on refugees and immigrants coming to the U.S. and in terms of global engagement of the U.S. Has been very, very challenging and very difficult. But I'm happy to report to you that the new administration is actually within a few days have issued several executive orders. They also promised to bring in about 125,000 refugees in FY 2021, which is going to be challenging. But they have rescinded a lot of very damaging migration policies. Including, deferred action for childhood arrivals, as also referred to DACA. They reversed the Muslim ban and the Africa ban. They're coming up with a lot of very, very positive policy in terms of refugees and immigrants. Again, the African refugees has been always the lowest refugee to be admitted to the U.S., and we believe that the new administration will consider, how refugees will be selected from what region. So we see a lot of good message from the administration. In fact, they extended the TPS, temporary protected status, for the Liberians also, which is a good news, because as you know, the Liberians TPS holder are still in this country without a status, most of them. So we see a lot of good changes. I think it's going to take time to recover from what we have lost in the past 4 years.
Elizabeth, what about you? What is the significance of the Nairo Sisters initiative based in San Diego?
Nairo Sisters Development Initiative is very, very significant. It's so crucial for refugees and immigrants coming to San Diego, to California in general. Since inception 2001 to now, we have supported thousands of refugees and immigrants to get integrated in the system. And we are statewide, and we are supported by federal, state, and some foundations in the services that we are providing, also including our county, the San Diego County. So our services is wrapped around, is holistic, I'll say, from helping mothers and families to access jobs, to navigate the system of services, to get housing, to put their children to school and mentor them and help their children to succeed in school. Now it's over almost 20 past years in these services. So Nairo Sisters is very, very significant to refugees and immigrants. Thank you.
Talk to us about the historical significance of the name Nile Sisters Initiative. What exactly does that mean, and why did you choose that name?
Thank you. The Nile Sisters Development Initiative came as we were discussing with the African refugees to form a support group. And we came up with several names, and we said that we don't want a name that will be exclusive, but we need a name that includes everybody. Everybody feels welcome in our services. And so Nile, being the longest river in Africa, it is very inclusive. And so we chose to be the Sisters of the Nile. That's the background of the name. So as of now, we are not serving only African refugees, but we extend our services to all refugees coming to San Diego, coming to California. We have the, of course, African refugees, and we have Middle East refugees coming from Haiti, from Burma. We have immigrants even coming from Mexico. So we are very diverse in our clients' base. We are very diverse in our staff. Our staff are from different backgrounds, from Africa, Haiti, Burma, including our host community members, the Americans. And so we are very, very diverse.
It seems to me that when I listen to you, you seem to be somehow either working with or complementing and perhaps supplementing the work of your fellow panelists.
Yes. We couldn't have come this far without really the support from Mr. Eskander Nagash. Mm-hmm. We are very, very grateful. He was the first ORR key staff who approved our community self-help grant from ORR. ORR is Office of Refugee Resettlement, and they have this initiative grant specifically for ethnic community-based organizations. And at the time, in 2012, when we applied for the grant, he was in that office. And definitely he saw the name, the Nile Sisters, and he knew that this is very significant. Is women-led African women and supporting refugees from the continent of Africa. Definitely that touched him, and our proposal was very strong, and so he approved our grant. We started doing training on certified nursing assistants. That was 2012, and it came all the way to now. As of now, in fact, we have established CNS school. We are training refugees, immigrants, displaced population here in San Diego and in the state of California to become certified nurse assistant. And that gives them the opportunity to get a job right away, well-paid job, and forever. And especially in this critical time of COVID-19, when healthcare workers are most needed, this is the opportunity Nile Sisters gives to refugees, immigrants, and displaced population to address the shortage of healthcare staff in this industry. We couldn't have come this far without Mr. Eskander's support when he was in the office. And to now, in fact, not only when he was in the office. So thank you so much.
Eskinder, what are some of the, what I call the fundamental root causes of this massive refugee situation?
Well, I think, Jack, the root cause of refugee always is conflict, you know. As you know, for the past 50, 60 years, one way or another, we have been witnessing conflict in Africa, as you know, going back to the 60s and in Nigeria, with Biafra issues, and just continued since then. You know, Africa is having refugees and IDPs. Just for historical purpose, prior to 1951, when the big powers decided to have a meeting in terms of refugees and came up with the 1951 convention about refugees, I don't believe at that time we had, maybe we had some displaced people, not refugees. But since then, you know, Africa is becoming the center of all refugees, except some of the major crises like Syria, like Iraq, and other places. Currently, as you know, sub-Saharan Africa has hosted more than 20% of the world refugee population. Over 18 million people in the region are of concern to UNHCR and to NGO community. The number is really increasing because of, you know, what's going on in Central African Republic, as you know, the ongoing challenge in Nigeria, and of course South Sudan. The sad thing is, 40 years ago, Shaka, the Sudan used to host a lot of refugees, mostly Ethiopian refugees at that time. After 40 years now, Sudan is hosting 60,000 refugees in the past 3 months. Not in the past 3 years, just in 3 months, Sudan is hosting 60,000 refugees. As I said previously, there are about 123 or 120 and 150,000 refugees still in eastern part of Sudan since 1968. Just mind you, with no option returning to their country of origin. These are Eritrean refugees. So when you look at everywhere, the African refugees are just a victim of the internal political crisis. I mean, since 1991, Kenya is holding over probably 400,000 refugees from Somalia in the Dadaab refugee camp. We still have a Kakuma refugee camp. We used to host a lot of South Sudanese. Now we have actually South Sudanese refugees also going to Ethiopia. And then we still have some refugees coming out of Somalia. So the root cause of, unfortunately, for refugees in Africa and elsewhere is the political crisis within their own country. The government's decision, you know, of about their own people and the question of rights, political rights, religious rights, the right to basically be a citizen of their own country. So the displacement of African refugees, I have a feeling, is going to continue because the political situation in Horn and the West is not getting better rather than getting worse.
You talk about those thousands of refugees who especially have been in the Sudan since the late 60s. Are there any options regarding resettlement of some of those refugees?
Unfortunately, the refugees in eastern Sudan didn't get a chance to get resettlement. In fact, most of them, I can assure you, that they want to go back to their country of origin. But unfortunately, the government is not willing to accept them. So they are just in that refugee camp, you know, maybe second, third generation refugees. They are not citizens of Sudan, and maybe, you know, Sudan may probably consider them. But the idea that, you know, other countries have to give you citizenship when your country is denying you that basic citizenship is a sad story. So they are the longest refugees in Africa, as you know, since 1968, as I say. And then you have the Somali refugees in Dadaab camp since 1991, after the fall of the Barre government. And then you have other refugees since 1975 in Algeria, called as Sahrawi refugees. So I think that, you know, the crisis continued because the international community, to some extent, ignored either the crisis or the plight of refugees. You cannot be in refugee camps since 1968 and 1975 and 1991 without any solution. Living very much, you know, it's a concentration camp. You know, it's like refugee warehousing. So they're there. I mean, the UNHCR is trying to help them to survive so they don't die of hunger. But outside that, you know, they don't see any future for them. That's why you see massive migration out of Africa to Europe. We haven't seen, you know, in history. They're going everywhere. Some of them are dying to, you know, to go to Europe. You know, and a number of Eritrean refugees and other African refugees ended up dying in the Mediterranean Sea, as if you remember. Yeah, and we still have refugees in Libya and Niger and other places, basically with no hope or no future. So I think the African Union, to some extent, you know, is not involved. I understand that, you know, if you are sending refugees, but at the same time also trying to solve refugees, doesn't make any sense, you know. So we have a challenge in Africa. There is a refugee hosting country is also a refugee sending country. You know, Ethiopia is hosting about 900,000 refugees, but Ethiopia is also sending 60,000 refugees to Sudan. So the crisis is this vicious circle that we are exchanging refugees, it seems to me. That's why, you know, the old system of keeping refugees for extended period of time, refugee camp, is really collapsing, and refugees are making a decision rather than just dying in refugee camp or living there for 20, 30, 40 years. They decided to try their luck, hoping that Europe will open the door, which is not the case.
You know, Negashville is saying that to whom much is given, more is expected. Any particular reason, for example, why the United States, which remains the only superpower on this planet Earth, cannot come up with some solutions to address some of these problems? Dealing with refugees, don't you really think some would say that when you are a superpower, it comes with the moral obligation?
You know, I think the U.S. has been a leading refugee resettlement country for many, many years. In fact, since 1980, the U.S. resettled about 3.4 million refugees than any other country. I'm not even adding the number of people coming to the U.S. applying for asylum. So U.S. government historically has been very, very welcoming and resettling more refugees, giving them a second chance to leave. I think the past 4 years is something completely different, not just only refugee resettlement, but the idea of refugees and immigrants as part of the U.S. foreign policy was completely wiped out. But I think the incoming administration, I have a feeling that, in fact, for the Central American issue, they're planning to ask up $4 billion for the next 5 years to really solve some of the chronic issues of poverty, displacement, and government persecution. So we'll see that this administration within 2-3 weeks taking this refugees and immigrant issue as a high priority. In fact, they will be sending a migration bill to Congress, to make some changes in terms of our immigration policy. But I think you are right. Since not all refugees will be resettled here or in someplace else, I think the United States and the UN and Security Council and the European Union need to take a lead in trying to solve this, protracted refugee situation. Not just only in Africa, but you have millions of refugees, Afghan refugees in Pakistan and Iran. You have Rohingya refugees, as you know, from Burma, mm-hmm. Now going to be shipped to an island and as refugee camp established. So we hope, and we do the advocacy work to see if the UN Security Council, the United States, and the European Union can take a lead in trying to solve this ongoing protracted conflict and refugee situation. If there is a will, there is a way. We the advocates are pushing, and I have a lot of confidence and hope that the new administration is going to lead by example when it comes to refugees and immigration issues.
Elizabeth, talk to us about some of the challenges that the Nile Sisters Initiative has encountered over the years, and how have you been able to overcome them?
Thank you, Mr. Shaka.
You're most welcome.
Nile Sisters Development Initiative evolved from my personal experience in being a newcomer to this country, not knowing the system and navigating the system to help myself get integrated with my family. So the challenges I see is first getting to know the system, the service system, from learning the basic skills, getting a job, driving, healthcare system, and housing, and then cultural difference. I see a lot of challenges, cultural shock among refugees coming to this country. Like back home, some of our men don't cook. But when they get here, a wife may go to school or go to work, and the husband has to cook. And then that's a challenge. When a wife gets money or salary, she has to contribute equally like the husband. And it is different like what was at home. So I see a lot of cultural differences, and that causes domestic violence among refugees and African refugees. So when I established Nile Sisters, we were providing skills, as I said, beginning with looking for jobs for refugees. And the CNA program was excellent, perfect, when highly needed in the community. So right now, we are providing the training. Our school is called Learn More. Mm-hmm. Learn More, and the website is learnmorefast.org. Nile Sisters website is nilesisters.org. So the services we provide is from giving them training, help them to understand the services in the country and addressing some of the issues that refugees face in cultural differences. FGM is female genital mutilation. Mm. Our people came with different cultures and behavior. So we educate both service providers and the population we serve to know the difference of this culture. And also we educate the families who are affected by FGM that this practice is not allowed here in this country by law.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa, and we'll be right back with you. So please don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And today we are talking about the refugee situation in Africa. My distinguished guests are Eskinder Negus, President and Chief Executive Officer of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And joining us from the Golden State City, San Diego, in California, of course, is Elizabeth Lowe, the Chief Executive Officer of the Nairo Sisters Initiative. How does a refugee, for example, learn or get the necessary information about the Nairo Sisters Initiative?
That's a great question. We are in the community. We live together with the population we serve. We are connected with the refugees and immigrants statewide. Our name is out there on the website at nilesisters.org. And our school is learn more and learnmorefast.org. The information goes just viral, number one. Number two, people we have been serving, they know the goodness of our service, how kind, how efficient and profound we are, the services we provide to them. So they become our mouthpiece, mm-hmm, to carry our message out to those who are coming after them. And then we have collaboration in the community. We collaborate with a lot of organizations, including government organization, the county, the government schools, the colleges. So we are well connected. That's how our information get out there, and that's how people come to our services. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now, Elizabeth, you come from a country which is now the Republic of South Sudan. You were probably born during the Civil War. Your people were fighting for freedom when they were part of the largest country on the African continent, otherwise the Republic of Sudan. Any particular reason, really, why you should be a refugee today rather than enjoying freedom back in Juba?
Valid question, great question, difficult to answer, but I'll try my best. It is emotional to me. I was born before the first civil war, I'll say in 61, I have been a refugee twice. This is my third time, and United States is the third country that has become my home now. I was a refugee in my childhood when the first civil war of Sudan started. My parents took refuge with me to Uganda. We were observed in by the indigenous, by the people of Uganda. By then, there was no refugee camps. Mm-hmm. I started my primary school in northern Uganda. And in 1972, when first Addis Ababa Agreement was signed, my parents got repatriated back.
You're talking about Anyanya 1.
Yes, Anyanya 1. Thank you.
Joseph Lagu.
Yes. You know it is so very well. In fact, Joseph Lagu is my cousin brother, too, just to be clear.
Interesting.
So when we came back from exile, I continued to go to school 10 years after the second Anyanya 2 war broke out. I got displaced from Juba to Khartoum. Khartoum became my second home for 8 years. The situation was not getting better. I couldn't go back to Juba. I couldn't stay in Khartoum. So I had to migrate from Khartoum to Kenya. And in Kenya, I was an urban refugee. I was in Kenya for 3 years. In 1999, on June the 3rd, God opened the way for me to come to the United States with my family. Mm-hmm. So I have been, my entire life, I've been a refugee. And that is one of the most and the biggest reason why I started Nile Sisters, because I know the challenges of refugees, and especially African women refugees face. So that's how I started Nile Sisters, first to help women, but now we are not only serving women, we are serving women and men. Just like a man is the head of the house, but a woman is the neck of the house. Without the neck, the head is not strong. So we support women, we are supporting men. Thank you.
Walk us through, if you could, through a day in the life of a typical African refugee. For example, what time do you go to bed? Do you have a bed anyway? How many meals do you get a day? And what time do you wake up? No matter where you actually live or call a bed.
Yes. The typical refugee life, if not supported, is stressful. Beginning with navigating the system, where to get food. Now, where to get food using public transport to go to grocery store or shopping. Back home where I came from, you can walk, you can use bicycle. If you want to go far, you can use buses or matatu.
But you have to have the money, you have to have transport.
Yes.
Where do you get that money from?
It is difficult. In my experience, when I first got here, I did not have a dime. And I did not know how to use public transport. The difference between the public transport service here and back home is in public transport, in buses, matatu, there is a bus conductor. When you enter in a bus, the conductor will come and collect money from you. But here in the United States, there is no conductor. There is a driver, there is a little box next to driver which doesn't talk to you. Nobody tells you what to do when you enter in a bus. And that box there doesn't give you a change. You have to know the right amount. You have to know the right place where you can insert your money and you go to sit. So it is a challenge. When a refugee enters in a bus, there must be somebody who needs to educate them how to use the bus service. You have to have either $1.75 or $2.50 and insert it in the right box. Don't expect it change back. That is education. As a result, to address that, now Nile Sisters is working with a governmental agency called SANDAC here in San Diego. We train, educate, and help refugees to understand the bus services, and not only bus, but other different transportation services like Uber, like carpooling, like using vouchers and transportation for seniors. So that is addressing transportation services. How about the food? To get healthy food, most of refugees are resettled in low-income places and in food desert areas. How do you get nutritive and healthy food? What is the value of eating salad? It's a new thing. Some of our people call salad grass. They, I'm not a go to eat fresh leaf. I need to cook. So we educate them on nutrition and food choices, reading food labels. Don't buy expired food. Don't buy fatty food. When you cook chicken or beef, trim off the fat that you can see, the skin. All this is educational for refugees. And another thing is sugary food, like cake, sodas, and juices. This is in plenty in low-income areas. So because it is also very cheap. So it is the most thing that, you know, when mothers go to store, they buy big cake, they buy sodas and put it there for. And it affects their health. Diabetes has become prevalent. Obesity has become prevalent. So we are educating our population on the importance of doing exercise. Eat well, exercise. Eat well, exercise. Back home, nobody talks about exercise. Well, because a lot of time...
You spend the day walking.
They walk. Yes, definitely. They spend time walking. Everything you want to do is you walk, you sweat. So whatever food you eat, you sweat it out, you walk it away. But here, it is different. They think it is luxury if you are able to eat sweet things, the cookies there on the table, cake, sodas, and it is different. So we have to educate them on healthy eating, healthy habits. You have to go and walk. It is not luxury. You have to walk. So that is a typical refugee's life. They spend a lot of times idle if they are not working at home, and their lifestyle has changed. But Nile Sisters is making a huge difference in educating them and supporting them to get on the right track, be healthy. And we motivate them to the extent we go to canyons, to clean canyons, to clean the street, and to make them socialize and get together to share their experiences. So that's something that we help also building their mental stage for healthy life and being productive citizens of this country. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Eskinda, when you talk about Africa, you said that the fundamental root causes of the refugee exodus is largely because of conflicts. How do we eliminate these conflicts and bring about good governance so that people do not really have to run away from their home? Because let's be honest, there is a saying that there is more than enough for all of us, except for the greed. How do we eliminate this greed business so that our people can live in their God-given paradises, really? When you talk about Africa, some people might get a false sense that Africa is poor. On the contrary, you and I know that Africa is arguably one of the wealthiest continent on this planet Earth. And yet, Africans are the poorest on this planet Earth. How do we somehow work out a way of empowering our people, of restoring our people's dignity, so that they do not become beggars, they do not start running around the world for a living?
Great question, as always, Shaka. Let me just add a few things to Elizabeth's organizational work. I think the Nile Sisters do a great job in providing those critical services. Just for our audience, there are over 1,000 organizations in the U.S. Serving refugees. Some of them are African organizations like the Nine Sisters. There are other organizations have been providing services to refugees. My organization has been providing those services since 1911. Actually, this is 110 years anniversary of our organization, not just African refugees, you know, Eastern European refugees. And the U.S., we have...
Let me take this opportunity to congratulate you on that.
Thank you. Thank you. So the U.S. has a very good refugee resettlement system. The government is involved. The Congress, on a yearly basis, appropriate millions of dollars to support refugees. When refugees are coming to this country, there is a system. That system actually treats them like any other American citizen who really needs some social services, whether it's food stamp, whether it's housing assistant. There are probably 220 different refugee resettlement sites in the U.S. When refugees are coming, there is somebody already assigned. They go pick them up at the airport, find them housing, provide them orientation. So it is a public partnership system. But one thing is that we have a system in every state and every county where refugees can access services. Elizabeth is right. You know, the transition from coming for a refugee camp to the U.S., for some of them, as you know, they were born and raised in refugee camps, so their exposure is very, very limited. So it's going to take time, you know, whether it's a bus service, whether it's law enforcement issue, whether they're getting English as a second language, all of that is going to take time. But overall, African refugees and other refugees actually succeeded in this country enormously in every aspect of the U.S. life, you know. In fact, unlike other refugees who came into this country before, we have now well-distinguished leaders in Congress who came in as refugees. So there is a lot of that refugees are doing in this country. They're contributing to the community. They're part of the community. But having said that, like any transition coming to a new country, a new language, a new culture, a new community, it's going to take some adjustment, and that integration process will take time. And as the Nile Sister had been doing for, you know, since her inception, that supplemental service is going to be very, very crucial as we go forward to make sure that refugees are succeeding, not, you know, staying in the government support for a long period of time. So I just wanted just to give you that the U.S. perspective, because Elizabeth was talking on the local California San Diego issue, but I wanted to give you the overall U.S. resettlement
Just staying in the U.S. very briefly, Iskender, if you don't mind, how does an average African refugee, for example, qualify for the refugee resettlement to the United States?
Yeah, that's a very good country. As I said, you know, we have about 26 plus million refugees. So the U.S. probably, and then other countries like Canada and Australia do take some refugees. So the process is when refugees are going to a refugee camp, let's say from South Sudan to Uganda, they will be registered by the UN organization called the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Once their refugee status is determined in Uganda, then, you know, the UNHCR could refer some of them for resettlement, and sometimes for the U.S., sometimes for Canada or Australia or other countries. So that's really how the system is, a referral system. Refugees will be asking, and then UNHCR will examine case by case and make a determination. I keep in mind, the average refugee staying refugee camp at least 17 years. And then, as I said before, we have still protracted refugee situation since 1991 in Somalia, since 1968, Eritrean refugees in Sudan, and then you have Sahrawi refugees since 1975. And, you know, the growing number that has been in Africa for a long period of time. So not all refugees get a chance, a select few get a chance to be resettled in the U.S. So every time there is a new government coming in, they model their governance style based on that cultural, governance they learned from the colonial power. This may not be the only excuse, but I think as long as there is corruption, as long as there is a lack of democracy, lack of rights, I think the issue of refugees and crisis in Africa will continue. Africa actually invests more in military hardware than in education or healthcare system. That tells you that our priority has been completely misplaced. And then, you know, we are not only one, you know, the people who are actually providing us sometimes is rather than books, they gave us military hardware. So we use that military hardware very much to displace our own people, to oppress our own people.
Iskender, if you could help us, you definitely occupy a very significant position. You've been a refugee yourself, and you now head one of the most important refugee institutions in the world. If you were to look in that camera, supposing some of the African leaders were watching or listening to this program, what would you say to them that they really need to do in order to help their people regain their God-given dignity of staying at home in the land of their ancestors?
That's a very challenging question, but I'll try. I think what I will say to the African leaders, the current leaders, if they are leaders, because I think it's very difficult for me to to call them leaders, because to lead, you know, you have to serve.
Correct.
So the mindset is they believe that these leaders, the people, are supposed to serve them rather than the leaders serving the people.
So you're talking about rulers, perhaps.
Exactly. We have rulers, not really leaders. You know, that they don't have a vision for the people. They don't want to listen to the people. They always have this fake election they do. I mean, you know, what every time we have election, you know, how many people died in Africa because of the controversy in election.
They conveniently refer to them as holding periodic elections.
Yes. Yeah, so I think, you know, we need a servant leadership in Africa rather than, you know, leaders wants to be served by the people. That has to change. I think we need to expand the civil society. Without the civil society, you know, the government's very much role without any check and balance. I think we need the African, based on our culture and history, a democratic transition. I think the diaspora or the intellectual, the elite class, who sometimes are also aiding and abetting the system, needs to do some self-examination. You know, as you said, Africa is rich, we have resources, but if we don't know how to manage what you have, it's barren, you know, it has no value. So I think it's very, very important for African leaders and African intellectuals to ask the question, how long are we going to be enduring this crisis? How many years can we be a recipient of foreign aid when we have plenty in our own country? I think that the international community also need to think, you know, Africa should not be in a position to be ruled or by foreign aid rather than by supporting Africans, you know, to support themselves. So there's a lot I can say, but at the end of the day, I think we need servant leaders in Africa. Until we get them, we have this fake election we do every 4 years, sometimes every five years. And then we create this system. I mean, somebody has been in a position for 35 years. You know, it creates its own class of people, so they don't want to give up. So that's part of the challenge we have. You know, we need to have a term limit. They keep changing the constitution every time they want to stay in power. And we have seen it, you know, from North Africa all the way, Central and West Africa and East Africa now. So I think we need to take an example of the South Africa, the newest country, you know, in such a short period of time. They had an election and they have actually chosen different people to take them to the next level, given all the crisis and what they inherited. So I think that's going to be my message. But I think the message is also for our people. We shouldn't accept the status quo. I understand, you know, these leaders have military behind them. They have tanks and jets. But at the same time, we have to say enough is enough. We can't go on like this, and we want to make, you know, our continent a better place for its people.
You said that when it comes to power, the oppressor does not cede power easily. What you can do perhaps is demand it or take it, and in order for you to do that, you have to organize, not agonize, but organize and mobilize.
Yes, yeah. You're right.
In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, let's keep the African hopes alive.